Today's Tay Show will be on Case 66 and the Hikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection, Blue Cliff Record, sometimes translated. Engo's introduction, adapting himself adroitly to circumstances, displaying the spirit to capture a tiger, attacking now from the front, now in the flank, planning to seize the rebel, combining light and dark, holding fast and letting go, dealing with deadly serpents. This is the teacher's task. Main subject, Ganto asked a monk, where are you from? The monk said, from the Western capital. Ganto said, after the rebellion of Koso had been suppressed, did you get the sword? The monk said, yes, I have got it. Ganto stretched out his neck before the monk and let forth a great yell. The monk said, your head has fallen. Ganto laughed loudly. Later, the monk visited Seppo, who asked, where are you from? The monk said, from Ganto. Seppo said, what did he say to you? The monk recounted the story. Seppo gave him 30 blows and drove him out of the Dokusan room. Secho's verse, since the rebel was suppressed, the sacred sword has been restored. Why the laughter? The master knows. Too small a reward, the 30 blows. One gains, one loses. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning and for such excellent sitting. Some of you who have been here from the first round of sitting and some came in the second round, and that's a lot of meditation for Saturday. It's really wonderful that you're here to practice. And even if you could just, you just had time to hear the talk, I'm very glad you took the time out. So this is actually a reference to events in real history and real Zen history and real Chinese history. So basically, Ganto and Seppo were Dharma brothers, you could say, and they had many students who studied with one and then studied with another. Eventually, Ganto was murdered. This is very famous in Zen history. Ganto was murdered during a period of political instability that is referred to in this koan. So some of you may, this all takes place during the Tang Dynasty. Some of you may have heard about the Tang Dynasty, but most people think of the Tang Dynasty as the high point one of the high points of Chinese culture, really this brilliant flourishing of knowledge and science, that technology was very far advanced in China, poetry, these amazing poets, and actually a government, good government. So there was a concubine who became empress, who instituted a system of imperial examinations, and those were actually beneficial. People used to just get positions because they knew somebody that knew somebody, or they were part of powerful families. And this concubine set up a system where you actually had to take an examination, and the people who passed the exam got to administer the state. They became the state bureaucracy. China was a bureaucratic empire. It was never really a feudal society like in Europe. It was a bureaucratically administered empire, and this woman had the great foresight to create a highly capable bureaucracy. So, you know, all of this was going on and things were going so well, but, you know, it all fell apart. You know, as things often do, right? I mean, this brilliant, flourishing period. But then there were a series of financial problems. There was an economic collapse, and they had to raise taxes, and there was this huge rebellion, which is sometimes called the Amushan Rebellion, and it wrecked. It didn't totally destroy the Tang Dynasty, but it wrecked the Tang, fatally wounded the Tang Dynasty, and the Tang Dynasty came back for a while. And then it finally fell. So, you know, this koan has a lot of resonance for people who know the history. And the interesting thing is that Ganto and Seppo were really brilliant Zen teachers. And Ganto got caught up in all of this. His temple was in a Wuchang and in Hubei province. When he was in the temple, there were lots of lawless bands running around. And this lawless band came into his temple, and they found nothing of value in the temple, but he was meditating, and somebody came up and stabbed him, right? And when they stabbed him, basically, he is supposed to have given a shout, right? Maybe it was Mu. But he shouted very loud. And his shout is sort of part of Zen literature, Ganto's shout. And actually, this bothered Hakuin Zenji very much. When Hakuin Zenji was a young monk, he was studying the great Chan masters of the Middle Kingdom, and he heard about Ganto's shout. And he thought, well, wait a minute, here's an enlightened person, right, who is deeply awake. And yet, you know, at the crucial minute when his bandit breaks in, he screams, right? Was that a scream of fear, of terror? You know, was he pleading for his life? You know, Hakuin was plunged into doubt about this. You know, only after he had one of his great awakenings did he realize what Ganto was really trying to communicate with that shout. And so the Ganto shout is quite famous, but the events of this koan take place between the time of the Amushan Rebellion and Ganto's murder, right? And so this is fraught, it's loaded with significance, right? Because this is about instability, right? Instability. And by the way, you know, I don't mean to be on a history jag this morning, but, you know, in China, there were many, in the Tang Dynasty, there were many schools of Buddhism. Tian Tai, Huayan, many, many. And when everything fell apart, in a way, you could say Zen and Pure Land were around to pick up the pieces. And the other schools never quite recovered their importance in Chinese culture. After this, Zen in particular, but also Pure Land, became really like central to Chinese culture, to Chinese civilization. And, you know, the interesting thing is that this is a horrific fact, but some historians think that something like 35% of the whole Chinese population was wiped out in this terrible period. So, you know, one of the ways to explain why Zen became so important was because it gave people the ability to deal with these terrible events, right? Somehow, you know, people were able to keep going and not get discouraged or not feel overwhelmed by like negative event after negative event. And I think that's a great secret of Zen, right? Great secret of our practice. You know, we've gotten through a period, right, that was terrible. You know, the last 5 years have been terrible, right? I mean, 30% of the country didn't die, but, you know, almost a million people will probably have died of COVID by the time this is all over, and here in the United States. And, you know, we had this terrible 4 years, and then we had this lockdown for almost 2 years. We're coming out of it now, right? But it's kind of traumatizing, yeah? I mean, I was just reading that mental health professionals are saying lots of people have been traumatized by this, you know? I don't have to tell, maybe I don't have to tell you this because we've all been traumatized. But, you know, it undermines your confidence in things, right? I mean, what I wanted to have happen in 2016 was for Hillary Clinton to win the election. And then I wanted Hillary Clinton to do some of the things that Joe Biden is doing now or trying to do now. And then, you know, that would have restored my faith in the political system, right? I would have said, well, it was a close election, but, the good guy won, right? But that didn't happen. A really bad guy won, right? Really bad. And then, you know, his whole cabinet were like, it was like the rogues gallery of the villains from Batman or something. It was terrifying, running the country. You know, and now Joe Biden is struggling with trying to put things to rights. So, you know, this is not so different. What happened in this koan is not so different from what's happening to us, right? And so, you know, it's important to use this as an opportunity to deepen our practice. You know, important to use this as an opportunity to deepen our practice. So let me read the koan one more time. A monk has come to see Ganto at his temple, and Ganto asks the monk, "Where are you from?" See, so I've mentioned this before, you know, but in China, you know, China's had one of the most amazing systems in the world. It's in world history. You know, if you know anything about Tibet, Tibet had lots of monasteries with lots of monks and nuns, a lot of people practicing Buddhism. But China did too. You know, China had a whole system of public temples. And I've mentioned that if you wanted to practice Zen or any other school of Buddhism in China during the Tang Dynasty, you had to get a license. That means you had to be licensed as a monk or a nun, and you could present yourself at any temple in the Middle Kingdom, and they would look at your papers, and if you were in good order, you would be brought into the temple. They'd say, "This is your bed, this is your bunk, you know, dinner is at noon, zazen is at, you know, starts at 2:30 in the afternoon, and please present yourself. And by the way, Sesshin is in 3 weeks, right?" And in this way, people all over China, you could travel all over China, you could see the world, like joining the Navy, right? You know, you could see the world, but also you cultivated awakening. And when you read about these great Zen teachers that had like 1,000 students who woke up, who achieved Daikensho, you think that has to be an exaggeration. But it wasn't an exaggeration. The system was set up to help people wake up, see? So it was this amazing system. Okay, so a monk who's just a beginner in this amazing educational system, you know, not just educating people's minds, but their wisdom. Ganto asked a monk who's just arrived at the temple with his papers in order, "Where are you from?" And the monk said, "I'm from the Western capital." That's like saying I'm from Washington, D.C., right, in the middle of the Civil War, right, or right after the Civil War. And Ganto said, "After the rebellion had been suppressed, did you get the sword?" See? And the monk said, "Yes, I've got it." So this is a reference to this sword that the rebel is supposed to have gotten as a gift from heaven, right? And used to fight the Tang Dynasty. So Gontal has asked him a question about his attainment, right? About his attainment. Did you get the sword? And you can think about this as meaning like the sword of power, or the sword of certainty, or the sword of righteousness. See, like righteousness. And the monk said, yes, I've got it. So then Gontal stretched out his neck like this, and he went, like he's getting his own, like getting his head chopped off. And he yells, he goes, ah, okay. The monk said, your head has fallen. Gontal laughed loudly. Okay. So later, the monk visited Seppo, Gontal's Dharma brother, who asked, where are you from? So this monk is making the rounds from temple to temple. He's gone to Gontal's temple. He's trained with Gontal for a while. Now he's going to Seppo's temple. And the monk said, Seppo said, where are you from? He said, from Gontal's temple. Seppo said, well, what did Gontal tell you these days? And the monk recounted the story. Seppo gave him 30 blows and drove him out. So he just, 30 blows didn't mean he punched him 30 times. It's symbolic, right? He might have had a little teaching stick and hit him on the shoulder a couple times and said, you're out, get out. That's not a good answer. So I don't approve of that pedagogy, but that's how it was done. So, you know, the koan is really about what is the monk missing? The monk didn't get it, right? The monk didn't get it. So, and both of these teachers are trying to help him get it, but what was it he didn't get? So that's the basic koan. So, you know, about a year ago, last March, I think it was, Tricycle Magazine asked me to give a talk. They had a series, a video series, on Zen practice in difficult times, right? We were in the height of the pandemic, and we had just come off of this incredible political cycle with a corrupt lunatic president. And they asked to, give a talk. So I gave a talk. And in the talk, I talked about the trauma of going through the Trump years and of COVID, you know. And the interesting thing is, as I was giving the talk, the people at Tricycle were monitoring responses. So there was you could put responses in the chat, basically. It was on Facebook, but there's a function in Facebook too that's like the chat in Zoom. And like, first of all, it was a lot of people showed up. It was a surprising number of people, like thousands of people tuned into this. But after I started talking about Trump, you could see the little thing the numbers go down a lot, right? It didn't go down to zero, fortunately, so I kept going. But a lot of numbers went down, and then there were lots of complaints. You know, people said, what is he talking about politics for? You know, this is religion. This has nothing to do with politics. Let's keep the politics out of religion, right? And people were really offended. Some people were really offended, you know. So anyway, you know, everybody has to make their own way in life. But I would say there's something very artificial about all of that, that response, if you're practicing Buddhism, right? It's not that I want everybody to vote for the Democratic Party, you know. It's that these things are happening to us. Right? These things are happening to us in our life. And if we try to wall them off and create a bubble of happiness, see, is that liberation or is that delusion, right? So, you know, again, feel free to come up with your own answer, but that is really what this koan is all about. See, the dynasty has almost fallen. A third of the country is dead. And a monk comes to Ganto and says, I'm just arrived. And Ganto says, Ganto says, you came from the Western capital. What's up? When the rebellion is over, did you get the sword? And one way to interpret what the student is saying is the student is saying, all good, teacher, all good. You know, I'm great. Everything's great. Everything's fine. So you could say that this student is like, you could say repressing, right? Nowadays, this is called spiritual bypassing, right? It's like, I want to be free from this. I want to be happy. And so I'm not going to deal with this, right? I'm going to wall it off. I'm going to create like happiness for myself. So, That's one way to experience this koan. That's one of the problems. Now, what does Ganto do? When they said, did you get the sword? You know, the monk goes, oh yeah, I got the sword, all good. And then Ganto sticks out his head like, I mean, the sword that cuts people's heads off. See, that went on just recently. Have you dealt with that? And the monk said, oh yeah, I've dealt with it. And then Ganto starts laughing. And the laugh is enigmatic, right? You say, what is that all about? Is Ganto saying, good work, be happy, see? So this is really complicated, but it's very important, right? I mean, this kind of spiritual bypassing is really always a danger in our practice. You know, I mean, when we start practicing Zen, most people who start Zen, some people are just curious or say they're just curious, but actually, usually there's something bothering them. They might not even know what it is, right? But something's troubling them. And they come to practice and you know, you sit down on the cushion and at first, if something's bothering you a lot, right? Something's really bothering you, it's very hard to focus your mind. So, you know, if you come to practice Zen and you're, you know, you're in an emotional crisis. Very difficult for you to do it, you know, very difficult. Because it's like you're right in the middle. It's like the house is burning down and you didn't, you know, fill up the water tank, you know, before you started pumping the water. So that's almost impossible to do. But if something has happened to you and you come to practice and you're not in an immediate crisis, see, you know, what happens to you is you begin to work with the breath, you begin to focus on the breath, and it does help, right? It's like, you know, eventually, you know, if you have problems with obsessive looping thoughts, you know, if you really discipline your mind to just focus on the breath, you know, those looping thoughts begin to recede, and you begin to enter this state that is very clear and calm. It's like centered and at ease, right? And that's highly desirable. We call that samadhi, right? Samai or ding. You know, so samai is this state of imperturbability, right? And it is a kind of release. It's so wonderful, right? I mean, we're not always able to get there, right? So in our daily lives, in our daily practice, you know, all kinds of things happen to us that are challenging and probably unfair, right? You know, really unfair. Things happen to us all the time that are unfair or that are you know, threatening or even dangerous, right? And you know, you sit down on the cushion and you're you're in fight or flight mode, or your confidence has been undermined. And it's so wonderful, wonderful, that we can get to a place where we can be calm and imperturbable, right? This is like an amazing fact, you know? It's an amazing fact that we can get to this place. If you don't practice regularly, it'll be very difficult to get to that place when you need it, right? And by the way, you know, if you've been away from your practice a little bit, you might notice that it's kind of hard to get back to that place. You really need to like train. Zen is like training, right? It's like you don't have to sit every day. You can take a vacation and so on. But it's like, you know, if you practice regularly, it becomes very easy to get into Sanmai, into Samadhi, quickly and deeply, right? You know, when I first started doing Zen, I didn't get there every time. I would come in and sit, and I would be in emotional distress, obsessive thinking through three sits, and I would go back to my apartment and, you know, be feeling slightly better, but not a lot. Eventually, you know, it would take me maybe two sits, but by the third sit, I was getting to that place of stillness and calm. And in that state, you realize that you don't have to, that emotional distress is not where you have to be. And I think that's a great moment of liberation. You know, normally we're in those loops and that's who we really are. And there's no alternative. And people drink, or they use drugs, or they develop compulsive behaviors. But, you know, when you can get to that place, it's so wonderful. It's so liberating, right? But it takes training, right? You get into that place where you're in samadhi, and, you know, eventually you sit down and you're in samadhi like that. I mean, I asked Genki Roshi, well, you know, when I was just beginning training, at one point we were alone in the Zendo, because he would come. Genki Roshi was a great Zen teacher, but he was also a ceramicist, right? He made beautiful tea bowls, and when we would get to the temple in the morning, he wasn't in the Chan Hall, he wasn't in the Zendo, he was in the basement throwing pots. So we'd go downstairs and Genki Roshi was in the basement. He didn't have his robes on. He had like this artist's clothes, you know, these canvas robe on. And we'd go, you know, time to sit. He'd look at it, oh, okay. And then he'd take that robe off, wash his hands. His other robes were hanging in there, and put those on, and he'd come up and sit with us. And he could be in a hurry, right? He'd turn off the wheel, he'd wash up quickly, run upstairs. And then he would just sit down and it was like, boom. And you knew he was in samadhi. It was like not a muscle was moving. Just like, boom. And you could feel it, the stillness coming off of him. So one day, everybody had gone to breakfast and we were about to leave for breakfast. But I said to Genki Roshi, how long does it take you to get into samadhi? And he said, like that, you know. He said, I imagine myself as an incense stick, and I feel the top of my head disappearing, and then it goes down to the bottom, and I'm gone, right? And it took me, you know, 15 years later, it would be possible to do that. So you build up this, like, samadhi power. You build up this, it's like you're rewiring your neural connections. You know, you keep repeating that process and you're strengthening the neural, one way to put it is you're strengthening the neural connections. So every time you watch a movie where people are in terror through the whole movie and you're in terror, and then you get up and the movie's over, you know, you're still carrying all of that. You've rehearsed being in fear for an hour and a half, right? And, you know, you keep reinforcing that and you begin to feel fearful a lot of the time. So, you know, our consciousness is the consciousness we create. You know, there's even been a lot of studies. Sociologists have done studies of people who watch a lot of TV and listen to a lot of news, and they say they have a greatly exaggerated sense of danger. And you wonder why. Well, I don't watch much TV, but I can remember, you know. So when you're sitting on the cushion and you're practicing entering samadhi, you know, you are reinforcing that mind that's able to be imperturbable in the middle of all this stuff, in the middle of all this chaos. So this is extremely valuable. And if you stop practicing, unfortunately, that gets to be harder to go to again. You know, if you practice regularly, you get into that still place, you're able to sustain deep samadhi. In one of the koans, the commentary by Master Umen, he says, you know, he's talking about the Zen master, and he says he's in such deep samadhi that if you hit him with a stick, he wouldn't even notice, right? So that's highly desirable state. But on the other hand, you know, there's a danger that we create a kind of cocoon of harmony around ourselves, and we're cutting ourselves off from the world around us. And this is very tempting, you know, very tempting. You know, we just finished the 4th of July, and everybody was reading on NPR, they have a reading of, you know, the Declaration of Independence. And, you know, this idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, we feel that happiness should be where we are all the time, right? We feel, you know, happiness is supposed to be our baseline condition in life. And, you know, Americans are educated to believe that, you know, we're told life is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And happiness is supposed to be our baseline state. But you know, it's interesting if you read early Buddhist sutras. You know, the first noble truth is suffering. So first noble truth is the truth of suffering. So, you know, it's interesting that the Buddha doesn't start out and say, basically, we're happy, but sometimes bad things happen and our happiness is interrupted. Right? He doesn't say that. He doesn't say, basically, we're happy people, but sometimes things happen to us that are bad. He says, actually, the human condition is defined primarily by suffering. That's the baseline. And he elaborates on that. You know, in Buddhism, there's this concept that you'll come across sometimes. They're called the three poisons. The three poisons. And the three poisons are greed, anger, and delusion, self-deceit. So you know, I was at a conference a couple of years ago where this very famous literary critic, her name is Gayatri Spivak, was giving a talk. It was a Modern Language Association. She was on a panel. And apparently Spivak has gotten very interested in Buddhism. I don't know if this is a new thing or not, but one of the people on the panel was a very well-known American Buddhist named Charles Johnson. He's primarily a novelist. But Charles Johnson was talking about Buddhism in this panel. And then Gayatri Spivak's turn to speak came, and she said something really interesting. And I don't always agree with everything she said, although I think she's really smart. She said, you know, according to the Buddha, human beings are basically greed, anger, and delusion. That's their baseline condition, you know? And that was surprising to me. I mean, of course, she is quite aware of suffering in the world. She's always been seen as a Marxist literary critic. And she does a lot of work with Dalit people in India, with the education of the Dalit community in India. And so she knows she's seen greed, anger, and delusion. But, you know, the interesting thing to me was that she put it that way so clearly. You know, the baseline human condition is not, I honestly, judging from my own experience, the way I was, I grew up, you know, I think I always thought the baseline human condition is happiness. But sometimes I'm not happy because there's something wrong with me. See, that's, and or mostly we're happy, but then bad things happen and it's not our fault and we try to get back to happiness. But the Buddha didn't say that. He said basically suffering is the baseline human condition. And actually happiness, you know, happiness is desirable, but it's not the baseline for humans, right? And so I think that's a really important insight. You know, one way of understanding this koan is that the monk in question doesn't want to say that to himself. He doesn't want to say, you know, basically, my baseline is greed, anger, and delusion. That's my, as a human being, right? As a human being, I am a human being. And I can tell you right now, unless I'm very careful, I am very egotistical. I'm not speaking hypothetically. I'm speaking as myself. You know, I, Kurt Spellmeyer, can be very self-centered. You know, very. Very, I can use other people for my own purposes, you know, and want them to think I'm a good guy, but I can do that, right? I can be blind to the suffering of others, right? I can be indifferent to their unhappiness if my happiness is protected. See? And, you know, that was true. That's true of me, definitely true of me. It was true of Genki Roshi. It's true of the Dalai Lama. It's true of the Dalai Lama. You know, in other words, all people are really like this. And if you think about it, that explains why history is so screwed up, right? I mean, the way I can just be honest with you, I come from a really unhappy family. My parents fought all the time. They eventually got divorced. After they got divorced, they didn't get any happier. They just found new ways to be unhappy, you know? But I grew up thinking, well, people are basically happy, you know, and you turn on TV and it's Leave It to Beaver or something and everybody's happy and there's a little problem and they're all back to happiness. And the message is the baseline is happiness, right? But, you know, actually in my family, happiness was quite rare. Moments of happiness were quite rare. So, you know, I would walk into a place, even as an adult, I'd go into a room and think, you know, everybody, I'm unhappy, but I'm sure everybody else here is happy, you know. But actually, that's not true. That's not true, right? And our culture tells us that's true, right? You open a magazine or there's an ad for Juul vaping, right? And the person who's vaping, he's having a wonderful time, you know, vaping. And the message is everybody's happy but you. And if you just get this thing, you'll be happy too. You'll join the club, right? So this is like a profoundly false view. And then when things like Trump happen or, you know, we're thrown for a loop, it's like, how can this be? Everything is supposed to be happy. But really, the world is full of people who are unhappy. Mostly, the Buddha says that's the baseline situation. And the Buddha says people are unhappy because they're motivated by greed, anger, and delusion. And we all have a Buddha nature. Inside of us, there is this enlightened mind that's 100% pure compassion. But it's naive to think that's the baseline. That's the baseline for Buddhas, right? That's the baseline for fully awakened people. It's not the baseline for ordinary people, right? So, you know, somebody can say, but, you know, aren't I fundamentally awake? And it's like, Your awakened mind is at the core of your consciousness. But I, Kurt Spellmeyer, am not fundamentally awake. You know, I have to work hard to wake up, right? I have to work hard. I sit every day, you know? And sometimes when I sit, I realize that I am screwed up in certain ways. I'll realize, oh, I used that person today, right? I used that person, you know, to bolster my something. I was feeling insecure, and I called somebody up because I knew they would give me a compliment, right? And it's like, that reminds me I'm really a great person, you know? So you know, there's no sense flagellating yourself. You know, if you review your egotistical moments, the list will be endless, right? So that's not what the Buddha said to do. The Buddha didn't say, search your soul for all your sins and flagellate yourself. That's a different religion, right? The Buddha said, cultivate awakened mind. Go into deep samadhi and enter the imperturbable, right? And then work through your obstacles in the spirit of loving kindness for yourself, right? Loving kindness. So, you know, when we're no longer desperate, when we're in samadhi and we're feeling calm and collected and at ease, see, now we're not desperate. We're not so down on ourselves or so full of self-loathing or so insecure that we can't begin to work through our obstacles, you know. And when you're in that state, by the way, of being imperturbable, sometimes you encounter like this great, great love. You know, bodhicitta is called the, you know, when you're just sometimes bodhicitta, this thing called bodhicitta. It's like sometimes you're sitting in your deep samadhi, deep samadhi, you suddenly just feel like this love, this generous love, generous kindness, right? Even for yourself. And now we're in a place where we can interact with others and we can interact with ourselves very differently, right? From this, not from desperation or insecurity, but from like this place of confidence, you know, and in contact with this loving kindness in ourselves. And we can also work through our obstacles, right? So one of the things we do in Zen is koan practice, right? Like this, you give a student a koan. And, you know, we are all a little bit like the monk in this story, right? We're all a little bit like the monk in this story. We don't want to work with the things that have we don't always want to work with the things that have hurt us or frightened us, right? We want to be happy, and that's a noble impulse. We want to be awake. But if we don't confront, you could say, our shadows, right? We can't wake up fully. We think we're open, but we're not as open as we think, right? If that makes any sense. And it's the work of a lifetime. You know, a few years ago, there was a scandal involving a Japanese teacher in New York City who had a series of affairs with his students. And eventually caused great unhappiness in his community. And they were secret affairs. They were furtive affairs, right? And when this came out, as things do, you know, created this huge unhappiness. Now, I actually know that person, and I actually studied with that person for a while. And in many ways, he was like a genius, right? But he didn't investigate all his shadows, right? He didn't look at all, you know, he began to cling to, he was a spiritually bypassing, right? He didn't say, oh my gosh, I'm using my Zen student, right? I'm craving her admiration and my sexual desire for her is really an expression of my insecurity about myself. I'm an old man and nothing special. And I want somebody to worship me, right? And And it's easy to fall into that trap if we aren't willing to investigate our shadows, right? And we've got a lot of shadows. You know, unless you're a Buddha, there's another one, right? And it takes a kind of courage and honesty to admit that, right? You know, I always say that if you ever meet anybody who says, you know, the world is full of spiritual teachers, if you ever meet somebody, Tibetan, Zen, whatever, and that person says, I'm fully awake, I am a fully realized person, please do yourself a favor, turn around and walk away and never go back. That person is living in a deep hell of self-deceit. You know, so and we'll drag other people in there too. You know, we are all working to become Buddhas. But, you know, the Buddhist teaching is a fully realized person. That's like one in a world age, right? The Dalai Lama doesn't say he's a Buddha. He actually, he always says, I'm just a simple monk. And I don't think that's bullshit. I think he's telling you what he thinks. I'm on the path, but I have a lot of stuff to do. You know, the Dalai Lama, from what I read, gets up every day and he meditates for 3 hours in the morning. And he had his Daikensha long ago. So you could say, well, what's he doing? You know, he's still cleaning up. He's working. There's still some shadows, right? And we create new ones. We'll create new ones tomorrow. So you could say, well, what's the point? Well, when you clean up your shadows, you feel better. You have love for other people. You're not deceiving yourself. You know how wonderful that is. You know, we all have to work hard to get it. You have to work hard to get there. You have to do a lot of sitting time, right? A lot of time on the cushion. You know, that's how we do it. A lot of time working through our obstacles. You know, nobody likes to do koan training particularly, right? Because you go in, the teacher says, no, I'm sorry. You know, you're working with this koan and you get rejected. And finally the teacher says, oh, okay, you know. And the thing about koans isn't the rejection. The thing that's so hard is that when you begin to work with the koan, you begin to encounter your stuff, right? Your problems. So, you know, basically you say, oh, I'll take this koan. You know, the monk, Ganto laughed loudly. You know, what's Ganto laughing about? Well, the monk is living in fear of the monk is traumatized by the events that have happened to him and his country. That's what this koan is all about. The monk is traumatized. His country almost fell apart. 25% of people have been killed. Ganto says, how's it going? And he goes, great. See? Great. Not a care in the world. When I'm in samadhi, all is well. And Ganto says, you have a big problem, my man. You have to work. You are really closed up. You're going to do some crying to get to the other shore. But when you do, your heart is going to be full of love. See? So, Engo's introduction, adapting himself adroitly to circumstances, displaying the spirit to capture a tiger, attacking now from the front, now in the flank, planning to seize the rebel, combining light and dark, holding fast and letting go, dealing with deadly serpents. This is the teacher's task. So a deeply accomplished person is not blocking all the time, is not spiritually bypassing all the time. See, when something happens to us that causes us to be afraid, we freeze. So if a tiger comes at us, if we're afraid, we freeze and the tiger eats us. But if we know how to deal with our fear because we've encountered it and worked it through many times, we know that's just fear. That's just fear. That's just a sense of loss. That's just a sense of abandonment. You know, I have been abandoned in reality many times, but I have been in abandonment countless times. And I have seen my sense of abandonment. So when I feel it, it's a different experience, right? Because I say, oh, yes, that sense of being abandoned. Okay. Ganto asked a monk, where are you from? The monk said, from the Western capital. Danto said, after the rebellion of Koso had been suppressed, did you get the sword? The monk said, yep, I've got it. Danto stretched out his neck before the monk and let forth a great yell. The monk said, your head has fallen. Danto laughed loudly. It's like, you have a ways to go, sonny boy. See, you're still traumatized. You are still traumatized. Okay. Later, the monk asked Seppo, where are you from? The monk said, from Danto. Seppo said, what did he say to you? The monk recounted the story. Seppo gave him 30 blows and drove him out. In other words, we have some work to do. You know, you're still traumatized. You're still traumatized. Okay. Sentra's verse. Since the rebel was suppressed, the sacred sword has been restored. Why the laughter? The master knows. Too small a reward, the 30 blows. One gains, one loses.